Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Modern party conventions are all about making the case for their presumptive nominees. That's why last night it was plaudits all around in day one of the Democratic 2020 virtual convention. But Biden the man is also the vehicle for the set of ideas, the vision of and for America advanced by the party itself. In other words, it's the platform the presumptive nominee stands on that tells voters what a potential Biden presidency hopes to achieve. And on that point, last night, it was Joe Biden's former primary rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who said,
"Many of the ideas we fought for that just a few years ago were considered radical are now mainstream."
Interesting that a little earlier in the DNC's first night, Republican John Kasich insisted that Biden wouldn't turn sharp left. So what does the Democrats' actual platform reveal? That's what we're going to dig into today. And to help us do that, Kimberly Atkins joins us. She's senior editorial writer for the Boston Globe, and she's in Washington. Hi there, Kimberly.
Hi, Meghna.
So I have got the party platform right here in front of me, and I know you do too. And just some of the sort of chapter headings I think are quite revealing here. It starts with protecting Americans and recovering from the COVID-19 pandemic. Of course, building a stronger, fairer economy. What else stands out to you?
Yeah, this is sort of, you know, the broad, you're talking about, Joe Biden talked about the soul of America. This is sort of an outline of the soul of the Democratic Party with this platform. Of course, it's not a binding document in any way. It's not a law, and it's not, nobody is forced to do all the things laid out in it, but it's sort of an expression of values. So yes, this year, fighting the pandemic is front and center. That's the first item in here, and it goes right into the economy and healthcare, which are natural offshoots. But it also gives a lot of attention to criminal justice reform. We know in the wake of George Floyd's death that has been a focus of Democrats, and also some things that we have seen in recent years, such as climate change. But as you said, Senator Sanders is right. Things like that. Environmental justice, climate change is continuing to get a broader place in the platform as the more progressive ideas come through. So it's a little something for everyone.
Oh, interesting. Right. Because we see here combating the climate crisis, as you're saying, environmental justice, creating a 21st century immigration system, which is something that both parties have been talking about ad nauseum. So perhaps not all that distinctive there. World-class education in every zip code. This grab bag approach is pretty typical for party platforms in most presidential election cycles. But just let me hear a little bit more from you, Kimberly. I mean, the assertion that Senator Sanders made last night about the mainstreaming of formerly, you know, radical ideas. Do we really see that here in many or most of this document?
I think we see it in some, and these changes are incremental, and it feels maybe even slower since we only get one of these every 4 years. But certainly when it comes to climate change, talking about healthcare, but one thing that you continue to see this year in particular, whereas last year, I remember being in Philadelphia and there was a real tension between supporters of, or 4 years ago, there was a mm-hmm. tension between Hillary Clinton supporters and Bernie Sanders supporters. And it was that you could feel the tension when it came to the nomination itself. What we're seeing this year is a lot of Democrats saying, you know what, beating Donald Trump is job one. So I will support Joe Biden. If that means beating Donald Trump, that means I'd support a pencil if it meant beating Donald Trump. But where we're seeing some push is with this platform. In a way, this platform is getting increased attention from people who want the Democrats to go further when it comes to things like police reform and criminal justice reform. They want them to go further and adopt things like Medicare for All instead of just offering a public option to Obamacare. So this is a place where I think the people who on the progressive side of the party are still looking to get more action even after Joe Biden is elected. The presidential election is just step one. They're looking for a lot more.
Interesting, because I mean, you pointed out healthcare. That was something I was just going to ask you about, because just to underscore that, the public option is in this platform, and Medicare for All very clearly is not. And of course, that was a central aspect of Bernie Sanders' campaign. And yet yesterday, he went out of his way repeatedly to say it doesn't matter, that he believes that there are actually bigger things at stake.
Yes, but there are a lot of Bernie Sanders delegates, a lot of people who supported him, who have already announced they're going to vote against this platform, in part because Medicare for All is not a part of it. So we are seeing that push on policy. Bernie Sanders endorsed Hillary Clinton 4 years ago in Philadelphia, but that didn't bring all of his supporters instantly on board. We're seeing that same kind of energy happening here, and we're certainly seeing it also in places like climate change and criminal justice reform. It's interesting because even this platform in some places is less progressive than Joe Biden's own position in climate change. Joe Biden set some benchmarks to meet by 2035, where that's years ahead of the benchmark set in this document. So we're seeing a lot of things all over the place. And so, again, this document isn't binding in any way, but it's clearly important. These folks want the Democrats to speak on this and embrace all of these progressive policies as mainstream.
I take your point that the platform isn't binding in any way, but I'm thinking about how it reveals where the energies of the party lie, right? Because, for example, in the 2016 Republican platform, there was a lot of conversation around the appearance of Ukraine in the party platform there. So it sort of gave us a window into some of the thinking of the political priorities of the party. But can you just tell me a little bit more about the climate piece that you just talked about? Because it's quite surprising that the Democratic Party platform wouldn't be even as aggressive on climate as their presumptive nominee.
Yeah, I mean, it really goes to show how Joe Biden, since securing the nomination, since becoming the presumptive nominee, really has been listening and trying to build as big a tent as he possibly can to bring everyone on board, to build that type of unity. It shows how people like Elizabeth Warren has been one of his key allies and advisors throughout this process. They've talked a lot, and he is moving to the left on some issues like climate change and embracing a faster timeline to impose some of these policies to reduce carbon emissions, to do other things that the progressives are pushing for. But on other things like healthcare, there is less of a movement there. He has not fully embraced Medicare for All, even though in polling, it seems that an increasing number of people are either supportive of Medicare for All or at least are willing to take a look at it. That's probably driven in part by the fact that so many people have lost their health insurance coverage during the pandemic because they have lost their jobs. So you're seeing the campaign, the Biden campaign, trying to be somewhat nimble here. And it's a lot different. It's a lot easier for a campaign to make these kind of changes than for the entire party as a whole, represented by the committee that puts this huge, massive platform document together. It's a little harder for them to move as quickly.
Okay. So Kimberly, if you hang on here for just a second, I'm going to turn back to you frequently through this hour as we sort of zoom in on three specific planks in the party platform about the economy, about criminal justice reform, and about healthcare. So let's first start with the economy. And joining us now is Brad DeLong. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy from 1993 to 1995. So in the administration of President Bill Clinton. Professor DeLong, welcome to On Point.
Welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So first of all, what do you make of the economic recipe that's put forth in this Democratic Party platform? The platform basically calls the Trump economy a failure and puts forth a lot of ideas on what the Democrats would do instead. Are they the right ideas?
I think broadly that they're the right ideas. I mean, there's no doubt that Trump made an awful lot of promises about the economy that he has not kept. He said his tax cut would materially boost economic growth by boosting investment in America. And yet, even before the coronavirus plague had hit, that was a complete failure. It had not boosted investment in America. The people who got the tax cut had not used it to boost how much they were spending on investment goods, on building factories and installing machines, but instead had used it all on other things. Trump managed to destroy our negotiating leverage with China on the first day of his presidency by vetoing the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was to give us a powerful group of allies for common negotiations with China. And even before the pandemic hit, the Trump economy was not doing that well, given the state at which the state of the economy he'd inherited. And of course, now everything's fallen apart. And I think the Democratic platform is the right road to get the economy working again in an equitable growth sense, not just extremely high values for the stock market, not just large profits, but instead broad-based wage increases and full employment.
Okay, so when we come back, Brad, we'll talk about some of the specifics in this economic portion of the Democratic Party platform. So Brad DeLong and Kimberly Atkins, stand by. We are looking at the ideas set forth in the Democratic Party platform, what's in it, what's not in it, and how realistic are the promises being made here. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about what's in the platform of the Democratic Party, specifically planks on the economy, on criminal justice reform, and on health care. What is the party promising or say it would like to do in the event of a Biden presidency? And how realistic is it? I'm joined today by Kimberly Atkins and Brad DeLong as well. And it was interesting last night, in the first night of the Democratic virtual convention, that these issues of policy actually weren't really front and center in the in the variety of speeches that we heard. But of course, the exception being Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. I mean, he almost had like the policy speech of the night. So for example, here is a moment where Senator Sanders talked in more detail about the kind of economic policy that he says the presumptive nominee would support.
Joe supports raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. This will give 40 million workers a pay raise and push the wage scale up for everyone else. Joe will also make it easier for workers to join unions, create 12 weeks of paid family leave, fund universal pre-K for 3- and 4-year-olds, and make child care affordable for millions of families.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders last night in the first night of the Democratic National Convention. Brad DeLong, respond to these specific aspects of the Democrats' economic plan here. I mean, Bernie Sanders went through the laundry list there. Are all of these things, you think, essential for realizing the vision that the Democrats would have for the U.S. economy?
Well, I would say that the smart money in economics now is on the view that raising the minimum wage substantially is probably the best thing you can do immediately to rebalance the distribution of income away from the what we've seen over the past 50 years, when the rich have gotten much, much richer, while the middle class and the poor have seen their standard of living barely edge up at all. And now looks like all of the fears that raising the minimum wage will discourage firms from hiring have been, at least at levels of the minimum wage we're contemplating, more or less completely false. You know, that when the minimum wage is very low, firms think we can cut our wages and yes, some people will quit and the rest of our workers will be stressed, but our organization can go on. With a higher minimum wage, they don't have that option. And so when they hire someone, they say, is what this someone's doing worth more than I'm paying them? As opposed to, if I can cut the wage I'm paying them a bit, then I can extract a lot of money from the workers who are already working for me who don't really have other options to leave.
You know, Brad, if I may ask, I read an article from Vox a year or two ago that reminded folks that you at one time called yourself a Reuben Democrat. Would you still call yourself that?
Indeed, right? I'm very proud to have worked for Bob Reuben, and I think he's a very smart man who's done an awful lot of good for America.
Yeah, the reason why I ask is because that label, it sort of evokes in one's mind market-friendly policies, sort of centrist democratic approaches to governance and managing the economy.
Yeah, those require Republican partners, right? Let's go back to what you were talking about earlier, about the public option versus Medicare for all. Yes, the platform calls not for Medicare for all, but for a public option. But everyone writing that platform, everyone in the Democratic policy community has learned the lesson from Obamacare, which is that even moderately complicated systems that run by the government work only if there is Republican buy-in. If Republicans decide that they want to destroy something the government's doing, they can do so very easily if it's even moderately complex. Hence, perhaps a public option is the best way to increase healthcare coverage and make our healthcare system better. I think it is. But I also know that a public option will only work if there is substantial Republican buy-in. If, say, people like Mitt Romney, who did Obamacare for Massachusetts 5 years before Obamacare passed, are willing to step up and say, well, this is the system I had, let's take it nationwide, let's support it. Without Republican buy-in, you need a simple system that can't be monkey wrenched, and that's Medicare for all. So us Reuben Democrats still have our own policy preferences, but we're well aware they won't work without at least some Republican support. So the platform calls for a public option, But everyone's aware that if we can't get bipartisan Republican buy-in on that, then the way forward for advancing healthcare has to be Medicare for all.
Really? So the way forward has to be the less centrist, more sort of...
No, that centrist things only work with good faith and cooperation to make the moderately complex systems work. If the moderately complex systems don't have that buy-in, we need to go back to much simpler and much less vulnerable to monkey wrenching systems. We need to go back to things like Medicare, like Social Security. I would have said go back to the post office, but it looks these days like even the post office is not immune from monkey wrenching.
So it sounds like really you're making what amounts to a political argument for the economic policies in this platform.
No, it's a policy implementation argument, right? It's that, you know, the president's job is to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. If a Republican president will not do that, right, will not accept that his job is to be our employee putting into practice the laws that Congress has passed, but instead to break things, then we need to make sure to design a system in which breaking things is as difficult as possible.
Kimberly Atkins, did you want to just respond to what you're hearing Brad DeLong say?
Yeah, you know, To the issue, I want to sort of broaden this a little bit to give people an idea and to get back to your point that yesterday didn't really feel policy focused with the exception of Senator Sanders' speech. The convention is trying to accomplish a lot of things, right? Including, telling as many people as possible, it's okay to vote for Joe Biden, even if you support Medicare for All and that's not in the platform. It's okay to vote for Joe Biden, even if you're a Republican. It's okay to vote for Joe Biden for a host of reasons, even if he's not your guy. I mean, that was almost explicitly stated by people like Michelle Obama. You know, he's not perfect, but he's the guy we've got. And so I think that is what you are seeing this dance here, right? It's very daunting to try to convince Democrats, some Democrats, to put something like Medicare for All in the platform, knowing that it could potentially scare off some other folks or seem as if it's going too far to the right. And they have other people who say, just as Brad is saying, well, this is the game because we know politically something else is not going to happen. We're not going to get some sort of compromise. That's the big political lesson of Obamacare. A lot of folks think that Barack Obama, when he had the political capital of a big win, historic election win, when he had Democratic control of Congress, that they should have gone further. But instead, they sought the Republican buy-in. It never came. The Democrats lost their supermajority in the Senate, and that is why you have the system that Republicans have been able to dismantle ever since. So,
as I remember it, the discussions I was in, at least in December and January of 2008, 2009, were that this thing is Romney Care. This thing is Romney's flagship initiative. We propose that. We get buy-in from Romney and from 30 Republican senators, and we truly advance the idea, you know, as Barack Obama rose to prominence by saying there's he did not see blue America or red America, but purple America. The Obamacare plan, as it was set out, was supposed to be the purple America consensus plan. What Mitt Romney would have tried to pass in 2009 had Mitt Romney beaten John McCain in the Republican primaries and had become president in January 21st, 2009. But the fact that we got zero buy-in, not from Romney, not from Susan Collins, not from McCain, not from all the Republicans who put themselves forward as, you know, bipartisan, centrist, and reasonable. That taught those of us in the Reuben wing of the Democratic Party a very hard lesson, which is indeed that we can put forward the centrist policies we think are best, But we should be well aware that when implementation comes around, we may not have any partners to our right to make sure that even moderately complicated things will be implemented in a way that gives them a good chance of working. Mm.
So just one or two quick last questions for you, Brad. I'm wondering if voters see the same dynamic at play as we're discussing here. And the reason why I ask is because, for example, I was looking at a CNN poll, and I know that there's some concerns around polling continuously, but a CNN poll that was just put out a couple of days ago, and digging deeper into to some of the polling questions, you know, they asked voters, who registered voters, who they think would be better in handling a variety of issues. The response to the corona outbreak, the coronavirus outbreak, healthcare, racial inequality, foreign policy. On those four things, Biden won the majority of the voters' responses. But on the economy, who would better handle the economy? President Trump got a 53% approval rating from the voters, or 53% of voters said they would he would handle the economy better. 45% said Biden would. I mean, if you're a Biden campaign person right now, shouldn't those numbers concern you?
Well, those numbers always concern Democrats because those numbers have been stable over the past 40 years or so, that people somehow believe that Republicans are to be trusted with the economy. It's their brand. Even though when you actually look at the numbers, times when Democrats have been president and when Democrats have controlled Congress have seen much faster economic growth and significantly faster and larger reductions in unemployment than times when Republicans have been in office and have controlled veto points. And, you know, we scratch our heads about this, first because of the very strength of the relationship. The economy does so much better under Democrats than Republicans that even people like me who think Democratic policies are better have a hard time understanding why the gap is so large. And second, given this very long history, now dating back to before Herbert Hoover, in which putting a Republican in control of your economy, well, you tend to get things like the Great Depression under Hoover, or you tend to get things like the great mismanagement of Wall Street regulation under George W. Bush that gave us the Great Recession of 12 years ago. Why this continues in the brand? My view is it's because of all you people in the media who every day use the value of the stock market as kind of a scoreboard for how the economy is doing. And, you know, the stock market is a nice thing, but the stock market is the wealth of a relatively small, highly concentrated class of Americans. It has very little to do with underlying sustainable trends of real wage levels or salaries of investment, which are the indicators that people ought to be looking at. I think if on the nightly news and all the cable news, you had not the stock market poked in your eye every hour, but something about wage growth or wage distribution or salaries or working conditions, that 53 might melt away very quickly. It might not. It's a puzzle.
You know, Brad, I'm not going to be defensive about that because I absolutely agree. I am very cognizant that in the NPR newscast before the broadcast of this very show, the first item in the NPR newscast is the opening numbers on the Dow. I hate it. I mean, all due respect to my NPR colleagues, I do not think it helps anybody to have our cortisol levels amplified every hour due to like the roulette game of the stock market. Completely agree. But go ahead.
Well, no, especially since the stock market, there are actually, as my old teacher Olivier Blanchard at MIT used to say, the stock market can go up if things are better, if people expect higher wages and profits in the future. And the stock market can go up if people get scared. If people get scared and are unwilling to buy bonds of various kinds, and so interest rates drop.
Yeah.
And so there's a stock market goes up on good news possibility, and a stock market goes up on bad news possibility. And right. certainly since March, it looks very much like we've been seeing the second, that the United States' response to coronavirus has been oceans worse than those of other North Atlantic and rich East Asian countries. Our economy is going to be depressed for quite a while other countries recover. And yet the stock market's doing fine.
You know, Brad, you've actually opened up an avenue of conversation that I wish we could go down unfortunately, I've just run out of time with you because we've got to move on to other aspects of the platform. I will just add this one note. Yes. Certainly, the media ought to be responsible for a lot of how information is spread and prioritized in this country. I would also say that perhaps another reason why the Democrats lose on these economic numbers in terms of perception of the economy is, in fact, just a thought here that, for example, economic policies coming out of, say, the Clinton administration didn't really work for some, if not a lot of Americans. So come back on the show sometime, Brad.
Oh, I will come back on the show.
We can discuss that.
I'll give a full-throated defense of Clinton policies as of being the best possible at the time.
I would love that, but we're trying to cram in too much this hour, so I'm going to have to say goodbye to you. Brad DeLong, Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy from 1993 to 1995. Thank you so much. Now, Kimberly Atkins, we have to take a quick break here. When we come back, we will talk about criminal justice and healthcare in a lot more detail, about what's promised in that Democratic 2020 platform. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the people who would be surrounding a would-be President Joe Biden, should he win the general election in November. So, for example, what do you want to hear from Senator Kamala Harris at the convention tomorrow? Of course, she is Biden's selection for his VP nominee. Who else do you think ought to be in a putative Biden cabinet? Share your thoughts with us at 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we're talking about what's in the Democratic Net Party platform, what the Democrats are promising as a party, what's realistic, what's not. You know, and most of the conversation about that in last night's convention came from Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. So here is Senator Sanders talking about criminal justice reform.
To help reform our broken criminal justice system, Joe will end private prisons and detention centers, cash bail, and the school-to-prison pipeline. And to heal the soul of our nation, Joe Biden will end the hate and division Trump has created. He will stop the demonization of immigrants, the coddling of white nationalists, the racist dog whistling, the religious bigotry, and the ugly attacks on women.
Well, joining us now is Brittany Packnett Cunningham. She's an activist and founder of Love and Power Works, a consulting agency on culture and justice. She's also a former fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics. Brittany, welcome to On Point.
Hello.
So you heard Senator Sanders there sort of lay out the list of some of the aspects of what a Biden presidency would hope to accomplish. Is it enough for you in terms of criminal justice reform?
Well, I certainly think that these things are a good step. And we have to remember that just a few years ago, people were not embracing wholly the ideas presented in that speech last night and some of these presented in the party platform. Things like ending cash bail, things like closing private prisons have been pushed by grassroots activists. And the conversation has shifted in such a way because of their efforts to actually bring us to this point. But most certainly, there is a long way to go. Private prisons make up just a small proportion of the number of places that incarcerate Americans every single day. And until we actually reach a place where we are fully abolishing those places, we still have work to do. There needs to be much more effort in rolling back the deep damage of the war on drugs. Repealing the 94 crime bill will be a critical first step for a Biden-Harris administration, as well as more immediately decriminalizing marijuana. In the party platform, we see them speaking about building a pathway toward that. But we believe that there is much more that can be urgently done, as has been demonstrated by a number of states at this point. We also believe that there needs to be deeper investment in the things that keep communities healthy. And I know that we're kind of taking this conversation piece by piece because that makes it more understandable and digestible, and that is the right thing to do. But I'd be remiss if I didn't help us recognize that talking about criminal justice, talking about police violence is connected to all of the other things that we are talking about, that it is deeply connected to the economy, to immigration, and so much more. We have to recognize that closing the wage gap and getting people into fair and equitable housing that hopefully they own more and more of is a pathway to end the over-policing in communities, because communities are being built to be healthy from the ground up. So all of these things are deeply connected. And I think the ways in which elected officials treat them as deeply connected moving forward here will be critical to us actually making progress on this very important issue.
Yeah, point well taken. And in addition, right now we're living in a world where all of it is even the connections are laid bare even more by virtue of this pandemic, right? So I really do take your point very well, Brittany. You know, you heard Brad DeLong a little earlier say that because of the political realities of this moment vis-a-vis the Democratic and Republican parties, that he feels that the biggest but most boldest ideas from the progressive left of the Democratic Party are the direction to go. You know, what's interesting to me is that in the area of mass incarceration in particular, we did have a moment of what seemed to be emerging bipartisan support, that we were just putting too many people for no reason in prison in the United States. So to me, it seems like this is one area in which the biggest, most boldest proposals should be the ones that the Democrats are pushing, because ostensibly they could find some across the aisle support here. So let me just be frank about this. Are you a little disappointed that you're not seeing the list of things that you just walked me through?
I am, but I fully believe in the possibility and probability of evolution, not just because we've seen folks on the ticket at all levels engage in that kind of evolution, but because we've seen the people really push them there. When we look at things like the Breathe Act, we've seen activists from all over the country, from grassroots, be very clear that defunding the police is not just a chant, that it can actually be seen in policy, and that it is not this scary vision of Batman or God. And rather without Batman, but rather it is a wholesale reinvestment in our communities, from education to housing to healthcare to social services. We need to make sure that people are getting the precise and a supportive, transformative care that they deserve, so that our communities are whole from the ground up. I fully agree with Brad that there is a direction to follow here, and that being unafraid to do that should be the headline of the Democrats. I think that
There is, again, a lot of possibility that that can be happening, even if it's not happening at the party platform. We're seeing people push from the inside and the outside. And frankly, that's what democracy is made of. So I don't spend a lot of time thinking about my disappointments. I spend a lot more time thinking about how we can get to work and how we can actually turn hope into real results for everyday people who need everything from a $15 minimum wage to the decriminalization of marijuana.
Well, Brittany Packnett Cunningham, founder and principal of Love and Power Works and a former fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we want to just save enough time to talk about healthcare, of course. It's a defining issue for the Democrats. Here is what Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders said about healthcare last night.
While Joe and I disagree on the best path to get universal coverage, he has a plan that will greatly expand healthcare and cut the cost of prescription drugs. Further, he will lower the eligibility age of Medicare from 65 down to 60.
Well, joining us now is Congressman Ro Khanna. He's a Democrat representing the South and East Bay regions of the San Francisco Bay Area. And he, in fact, voted against the Democratic Party platform on Saturday. And he joins us from Washington. Congressman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you for having me.
So is it the lack of Medicare for All in the party platform that led you to vote against it?
Yes, it is. As you know, Medicare for All was part of our platform until 1980. And at this moment in our country, when millions of people are losing their jobs, we should say that losing your job doesn't mean losing your health care. I believe we have to go back to the platform that was there post-Truman.
And so, but then you heard also the notion that expanding the public option, even though it may not be palatable to the progressive left of the Democratic Party, it's something that obviously Joe Biden is willing to stand by, and that those key voters in the middle that the Democrats need to grab in order to win in November, that they might be more likely to support. I mean, is that not a sort of a viable or a convincing argument to you?
Well, there are two different things. I mean, I'm fully in support of Joe Biden, and I do agree that his public option plan is better than the status quo, and we need to do everything we can to support him. But that should not mean that our party abandoned the goal, which has been the goal since FDR and Truman, of making sure Medicare expands to everyone. And we can have Joe Biden running on his campaign, but still have a party platform that says the goal should be Medicare for everyone. And then Medicare expansion, as Bernie Sanders said, it doesn't have to be all at once. It can start by going to people down to 60, 55, and then eventually cover everyone.
Yeah. So can we talk about that a little more, Congressman? Because I don't think it's actually being discussed enough, this idea of lowering the eligibility age of Medicare down to 60. And that would capture a lot of people here. I mean, is that tell me more about why that's in this platform here.
Well, even Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All plan calls for a transition, and it happens over 4 years. Under Bernie Sanders' plan, you would have Medicare first extended to people down to 55, then 45, then 35. Finally, in the fourth year, everyone is covered. And Joe Biden has said he's willing to extend Medicare to people 60 and over. I think that's a very strong first step in getting Medicare to everyone. And it's why Bernie Sanders highlighted that aspect of Joe Biden's plan last night.
Mm-hmm. And so tell me a little bit more then about just even this first incremental step of lowering it to 60. How would that be done? There's going to be forever the question of paying for it.
Well, the argument is simple. I mean, we currently pay for Medicare, and this will allow people who are over 60 to be enrolled automatically in Medicare. Now, they still can have supplemental private insurance. But if anything, I think this will lower costs because Medicare is cheaper than a lot of private health insurance plans, and it will end up lowering costs for a lot of businesses, a lot of employers, and we will be able to pay for it with partly the employer tax that is currently on every employee for Medicare.
Hmm. Well, overall, Congressman, one last question for you here. What do you see in this platform? What vision for America do you see Democrats trying to advance here? And then do you believe it's a realistic one?
The platform is a vision for prioritizing the working class and the middle class. I mean, we've seen the last 30 years worker productivity has increased by 70-80%, but worker wages have only increased by 8%. You've seen a lot of the wealth creation benefit the top, benefit the coast. It has left out a lot of the middle of this country. It's left out a lot of minority communities. And what Democrats are saying is it's time to rebuild our economy with a consideration for those communities and people who have been left out, and to prioritize the working and middle class again. And I do think that's realistic, and I think it's going to resonate.
Mm. Well, Representative Ro Khanna is a Democrat representing the South and East Bay regions of the San Francisco Bay Area. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
So, Kimberly Atkins, I appreciate your patience in sticking with us this hour and listening to all those voices here. Sort of, let's take a step back here. What do you think of the diversity of views around this platform itself? To your point earlier, Kimberly, it's not a binding document; it's more of an aspirational
right.
one. So what are the Democrats really trying to communicate that they are aspiring to here?
Well, I think that this is a document that isn't moving as quickly as the events in the world that are and in the country that are affecting Democratic thought. And I think there are more people who are wanting things like Medicare for All that is not necessarily that's not in this platform, that may not have the majority of Democratic support or other things. I mean, I was doing a quick search while you were talking to Brittany, and the word defund does not appear in this document. Mm-hmm. There's nothing about defunding police and all of the BREATHE Act components that she talked about. It's not in here, but that has come up in the last several months. This document was 4 years in the making. And so I think just because you don't see some of these policies in there, it doesn't mean that it's not a part of the Democratic base and that support for it isn't growing among even more establishment Democrats. We'll have to wait and see for that. But I think that's one thing when you have a party at this point that is so big, so broad in terms of the different components within it, when you're trying to put an umbrella over that, it's not always that easy.
Yeah. You know, Kimberly, as you know, I love talking about policy. So do you, which is why I love having you on here, because I think the policy is where rubber meets the road, regardless of what party you're
yes.
talking about. But I still am very aware that last night, in the first night of the Democratic National Convention, what we saw was policy really being relegated to Senator Sanders gets to talk about it. The rest of the 2 hours was not about that, really, at all.
Yeah.
So ultimately, the policy battles seem to be somewhat internal to the Democratic Party, but the external face that they presented last night was something entirely different. Talk to me about what you saw in the first night of the virtual DNC.
I mean, the first night of the virtual DNC was about the really getting across the urgency of the Democrats' message that the number one job is to defeat Donald Trump, that all these other things, all the policy discussions can happen after that. And I think you're even hearing that when you're talking to people like Congressman Khanna and Brittany and other people who are talking about these progressive policies. It's almost as if getting Joe Biden elected is even before you get to the starting line, that they are interested in pushing Democrats. If Democrats are in the White House, they're interested in pushing them on these issues too. And they're interested in hashing out these policy debates. Whereas before, it seemed in 2016, it was sort of this deflation almost among the more progressive parts of the party in Philadelphia after Hillary Clinton got that nomination. It seems more of a determined desire to push forward on policies like criminal justice, like healthcare, like the economy moving forward. And the message last night was we can all, you know, the party can come together and even embrace Republicans if it gets Democrats closer to that point.
That's right. And the other message seemed that policy will come, but the Democrats, if they want to enact any of those policies, they have to win first.
Correct.
And winning focused, that's why their message was focused also on the current occupant of the White House as well. So Kimberly Atkins, senior editorial writer at the Boston Globe. Kimberly, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.